Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's occasional lecture in our long-running series of occasional lectures brought to you by the Senate. This year we've brought to you a number of international perspectives on the work that goes on here. We've had visitors from Ireland, the United States. We've got a visitor coming in the next couple of months from the UK. Last month we had an Australian academic talking about the UK election processes and the political parties in the UK. So this month we've turned the tables and we have an American to talk to us about one of our dear institutions in Canberra, the cartoons of Jeff Pryor. Kathleen Burns is a long-time friend of Australia. I think she just told me this was her eighth visit. And in the 1990s she was the only American in the press gallery here in Parliament House. And if you've been following this series for a very long time, you might recall that she has spoken to us on a couple of occasions previously in the 1990s. But today I'd like you to welcome back to the Senate Kathleen Burns to talk about the work of Jeff Pryor.
Thank you very much. If I have to dip over to get a drink of water, I managed to catch a tremendous cough, and it was because it was 104 degrees when I left Washington, and it's not 104 degrees here. So, again, thank you very much. We didn't know that you locked the doors, and I thought, no one is coming. I'm delighted to be back. I came to Australia in November 1990. I remember we were getting ready to land the plane, and I thought, I don't see a city. And we dipped down, and then we came to Canberra. It was very exciting to be in the press gallery. I saw Lee Sales, who had been in the Washington press gallery when I was in Washington. I thought, to see these familiar faces. I saw Carrie O'Brien last week. I was at the Byron Bay Writers Festival, and I said, oh, you used to be my neighbor, and I thought, it would be like if in America, would you go up and talk to Walter Cronkite? Probably not, but Carrie O'Brien is very low-key. A personal thanks to Dr. Lang for this invitation, and also to her predecessor, Harry Evans, who had invited me in the past, and also to the people in the clerk's office who made this visit possible. I appreciate all the effort that went into this. During my years of wandering these hallowed halls, I wrote almost 500 articles for different American media. I served in the press pool when Queen Elizabeth came, and also for visiting dignitaries such as the U.S. Secretary of State. I was standing in this very building in the Great Hall when President Bush the first arrived, and it was an amazing thing to see American flags flying over the government building of another country. It was very touching. Part of me, being married to someone in the FBI, made me wonder, is this legal to do that? The visit galvanized for me the visit of the first President Bush, the meeting of nuance in words, drawings, and body language. And I'll talk about that in terms of political cartooning. But it quickly acquainted me with the fact that Australian words and gestures can mean very, very different things and sometimes generate unintended consequences and embarrassing results. In 1991, at a lovely lunch the Australian government had organized for President Bush the first, I was sitting at a table of young and very enthusiastic Republican aides who were amazed to hear Canberra described as the Bush capital. One staffer promptly noted, I had no idea they loved our president. A State Department aide quietly pointed out that Bush and Australia met the countryside and had nothing to do with politics. The Republican remained quiet for the rest of the lunch. Unfortunately, in all the briefings Bush had received for this trip, no one had thought to say to him, these are bad words and bad gestures in Australia. Try not to use any of them. So there he was, in the midst of very angry farmers, upset over some protective U.S. agricultural legislation, waving his hands in front of the Parliament, in what he thought was the V for victory sign, but he turned his wrist the wrong way. Bad luck. Like all campaigning politicians, Bush was very eager to shake hands with crowds. One eager Australian bystander caught the president totally off guard when she thrust a baby into his arms and said to him, "Would you like to nurse this baby?" Unfortunately, no one had explained that the Australian context was quite different from the American biological context. Bush was very sheepish, and he said, "I may be president of the United States, but I know my limits." It was probably one of his better lines. You did not see the story in the U.S. papers or in the prior cartoons, but it would have been pretty funny. You may remember this trip because it got off to a bad start from the very beginning. President Bush landed in end of December 1991 and stayed till the beginning of 1992. He was going to campaign against Bill Clinton for the presidency, and his staff wanted to show what exceptionally good shape he was in spite of this grueling trip. Even flying on Air Force One is a tough trip. And his age, he was in his 60s, so they had him jog around Sydney. They had him jog around Canberra. And when he went on to Japan, he wasn't feeling so good. I was with the CNN press pool at this time, and to the amazement of everybody, CNN announced first that he was ill and then that he had died. If you could die from embarrassment, he certainly would have when he threw up on international TV on top of the Japanese prime minister. Such are the foibles and follies of men and politicians. Their actions do not go unnoticed by an ever-vigilant press. As a longtime journalist, I fully believe in the cliché, the pen is mightier than the sword. And as a writer, I also subscribe to the cliché that a picture is worth a thousand words. Nowhere is this more true than when the pen is in the hand of a very skillful political cartoonist who uses a deft stroke to level tyrants, to puncture the pompous, to reflect on aspects of humanity, to question social norms or the lack thereof, and to create needed humor and comic relief in viewing the weakness and quirks of nations and men. Besides the artistic vision and drafting skills needed to generate an instant impact, the political cartoonist must also have a grasp of human psychology, history and geography, world events, and perspective. Often the drawing is not to make people laugh, but to force them to confront moral and social issues that others seek to avoid, or to force a rethinking on aspects of the status quo. This is a picture of Jeff Pryor. For those of you that aren't familiar, I'd also like to give my appreciation to the National Library of Australia, who really is very helpful on interline research. Jeff Pryor was with the Canberra Times from 1978 till his retirement in February 2008. There were no sacred cows that escaped his powerful pen as he focused on politicians and the public alike, both in Canberra and around the world, and including Washington, D.C. In 2004, Jeff Pryor won the People's Choice Award, which was given by the National Museum of Australia Behind the Lines exhibit. He beat out 65 fellow Australian cartoonists for this award. Pryor's winning entry, the decision, was in response to John Howard's announcement to continue as a Liberal Party leader and shows the Prime Minister in his Sydney home in Kirribilli. And unfortunately, we could not track this one down. But the next one is equally a signature cartoon, Keeping the Little Lady Off My Back. It shows Howard with Queen Elizabeth II in the background after being nominated for the Order of the Garter. And I thought this was a funny difference in the United States. We would never give anybody an award for a garter. The next one is the retrospective exhibit that they did on Jeff Pryor. His work was shown at the National Museum of Australia in Canberra here from November 29, 2008 and ran through February 12, 2009. I just missed it. I've been here in September 2008. Described in this exhibit brochures as an astute observer and commentator of the world around him, Pryor carefully dissected and exposed the motivations of Australians' politicians. All of his work, to the last cartoon, was produced via simple pen and ink renderings, an increasingly rare skill in the new world of digital cartoons. According to the show's promotional literature, Pryor, working from the basis that political commentary takes precedence over artwork, he carefully dissected and exposed the motivations of Australians' politicians. But leaders around the world were also fair game for his stiletto pen. With laser-like precision, he focused on Idi Amin of Uganda, the Shah of Iran, and the Pope. He also loved skewering U.S. politicians as much as he did Australian ones, and his work ran from President Nixon to President George Bush II. Today's election campaign in Australia would be a very different campaign if Pryor was still on the job. While the candidates may be dodging the issues, Pryor would not. Next one is something that I think is very characteristic of Pryor. And we kid in the United States that we came from the Puritan culture and you came from the convict culture. This was a very signature cartoon that Pryor did during the Bill Clinton impeachment year from 1999, January through December. And he's making fun of the Congress members of the United States who demanded this impeachment with, it says, "We did it for God-fearing, clean-living Americans everywhere. We did it for the Constitution of the United States. But most of all, we did it for Richard Nixon." And I think this cartoon sort of sums up Pryor's view of hypocrisy. At the same time, we were having our version of the Spanish Inquisition that was led by Newt Gingrich, who was the Republican Speaker of the House. He was having an affair with the woman who was to become his third wife. I don't think people support having affairs, but certainly in other countries of the world, this would not have risen to the level that it did in the United States. In looking at Pryor's cartoons, I like to remind myself that some U.S. audiences still cling to the Puritan culture, and many of Pryor's works would never have made it into print in our own country. This is aside from the fact that we readily proclaim our First Amendment rights in the Constitution to free speech. But there is also a question of taste, of shock value, ethnic sensitivities, and I will talk about those a bit later. Pryor had no qualms about lampooning American politicians and practices with bullseye skill. He tackled the wars that the Australians and Americans fought jointly from Vietnam to Afghanistan from World War I on. And while mindful of the Australian mantra that we fought shoulder to shoulder with the Americans in every war, he also lowered the boom on Americans' response to the trade wars. Where American agricultural protectionism undercut Australian markets, in 2005, the Americans signed a trade agreement with Australia. Our provisions went into effect the next day. Some of your provisions, such as meat, will take 29 years, and sugar wasn't even on the table. Pryor also took a very hard look at the September 2001 events with the bombings in New York, the Pentagon, and in Pennsylvania. I live about 10 minutes from the Pentagon. My daughter's school shook, and my neighbor actually saw the plane enter the building, and a friend of mine died in that crash. Pryor focused on the worldwide ripples that this had created. His drawing board tackled the questions in both the United States and in Australia of the U.S. government's new uses of powers of detention, secrecy, torture, rendition, where you secretly move people into prisons with no notice. He also questioned issues of privacy, personal freedom, and transparency. Pryor hit a nerve when he zeroed in on the controversies of immigration and asylum, race, and guns, with wide reverberations. One of his most powerful cartoons directed against the United States was the Fair Trade Bible with a handgun tucked inside the pages of this book, and I'll show you that in a minute. It's interesting that this remains a very controversial issue in the United States. The Supreme Court recently lifted the ban on gun control, in spite of the fact that an estimated 60,000 people are shot to death in the United States every year. Love him or hate him, Pryor proved to be a national icon. He evokes strong national sentiments, depending on the viewer's perspective, on controversial issues. He was always a hot topic at the breakfast table or after work at the bar. While he often focused on strictly domestic issues in Australia, he never lost his international perspective, with the world as his drawing board. And my hope is that someday he will be honored with a show in Washington, D.C., just like his Australian counterpart, Patrick Oliphant, who is a cartoonist and a sculptor. I had thought he'd gotten very close recently. Before I left, I was interviewing by telephone the Australian ambassador, Kim Beazley, and we had a very bad phone connection. And I had said, gee, I hope someday you will be able to push a show with Jeff Pryor. He thought I said Greg Pryor, who's a relatively unknown print artist in Western Australia, and went on at great length about how this was going to be a fabulous show, and I got all excited. About 10 minutes after we hung up, the cultural affairs person, Brendan Fall, called me and he said, we've had a terrible miscommunication here. And I thought, this is how rumors and wars start. Examining the vital role of cartooning in modern life, Australian ABC commentator Philip Adams once noted that Australians produce so many good cartoonists, and I'd have to agree. So many that you'd swear our political life exists to mimic their cartoons. For as the days pass, I have the strange feeling that their art precedes rather than imitates life, that they are not descriptive but predictive. Adams further adds that, quote, their skills are by an order of magnitude greater than ours as writers and infinitely more important than the anonymous huffings and puffings of editorial writers. I may say that through clenched teeth, but it must be said. In his remarks, Adams also compares cartoonists to seismologists who chart the shifts of the earth under the earth's surface and the responses of onlookers. Quote, the cartoonists have their ears to the ground, ready to amplify each tremor, right up to and including the major upheavals, not content with the mere reactions or simple calibrations. The cartoonists are duty-bound to exaggerate the scale of the conflict in the hope of alerting us to an untoward event or preposterous utterance. Okay, I'm straining for metaphors, said Adams, but so do cartoonists. But if the Richter and his scale are too distant from human events, then perhaps I should equate cartoonists with lie detection. In another work, Two Men in Some Boats, the cartoonists in 2001, with writers Hayden Manning and Robert Fidian, they reviewed 350 Australian cartoons that ran during the election year of 2001. In assessing the variety of interpretations and topics chosen by these cartoonists, the two observed that the Australian cartoonists do not consistently fit into the elites category derided by John Howard. Their hostility towards business of politics, policymaking, and political correctness makes them unreliable members of the chattering classes. Fidian and Hayden continue. Many of the cartoonists cherish their status as the voice of the little bloke's view on the editorial page, and they are as cynical as the best of them. But one issue where Australian cartoonists were galvanized was on the ethical and moral questions surrounding the asylum debate, which is an ongoing debate today still. This followed the drowning of 350 refugees off the Australian coast near Java. Said the two writers, surely the cartoonists thought this was enough to humanize the refugees and would make Australians feel the issue with greater sympathy. Added Manning and Fidian, on this issue, they, the cartoonists, took a moral stand. It could not be written off as a conspiracy of class traitors in the liberal broadsheets because cartoonists ran just as strongly outside Sydney, Melbourne, and Canberra as they did in the tabloids as well. Pryor has two cartoons when he focused on the asylum people. The first one just says, boat people, we'd love to mate, but we're chock-a-block full. And the second one is, caution, prisoners escaping Long Bay. With a very Australian idea of you have signs with all the different road crossings. Another triggering event was the terrorist attacks in the United States of September 11th, 2001, and the impact they had not only on the United States, but on Australia and the rest of the world. In tandem with the asylum issue, the other essential component of the xenophobic hysteria was the war against terrorism and Australians rallying in exuberant loyalty to the U.S. Researchers Manning and Fidian wrote that the Australian newspaper cartoonists, quote, worked in the shadow of 11 September and the war against terrorism. It was a dark shadow. The two stressed that in the last couple of Australian elections, we have argued that cartoonists have become increasingly disgusted by and disengaged from the process. We must tell a different story for 2001. Cartoonists were more disgusted than ever by the elections, but they certainly were not disengaged. The issue that inspired them were the moral questions of how we should treat asylum seekers, who arrive in boats in the sense that the war in Afghanistan, viscerally, if not entirely logically connected to it, was being exploited for political purposes. This anger tended to wash over the coverage of the issue, leading to cartoonist campaign marked by plenty of satirical darkness and little comic relief. The authors criticized the cartoons for this shift into emotion. Quote, "They were more unfair and powerful than any campaign we have yet covered," said Manning and Fidian. And I find it interesting, having been in the country 2 weeks, that the war in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan is a non-issue, although you've been fighting with us for 11 years, and it's now approaching, in the United States, a $1 trillion war. Pryor jumped into this fray. This cartoon is titled Subtlety. It was done on November 5th, 2001, and shows John Howard and his campaign staff listening to an unseen television voice which says, "Vote Labor and get a terrorist for a neighbor." An advisor chimes in the subliminal subtext of the subtext, "That does it." This was a big thing in the United States, too, about all these subliminal messages with advertising, both political and regular. Another one is called Videotape. Pryor is described by Manning and Fidian as highlighting the amorality of retiring Peter Reith, the Liberals' treasurer, in a cartoon reference to the asylum seekers' fiasco. Writer Malcolm McGregor of The Australian was cited by the two researchers for his comment that, quote, "When Liberal MP Julie Bishop and Labour candidate Peter Noddle can't say what at least a significant minority of Australians think about refugees and terrorism, the two most visceral, totemic issues of this 2001 campaign, there is something seriously wrong with our electoral system." Cartoonists did not share that silence. Quote, "This was the conclusion of the cartoonists in their focus on the sanctimonious, hypocritical, and often mean-spirited treatment of boat people by political leaders and the sickening discipline that showed by the beat of the drum or the playing card," according to McGregor. Writers Manning and Fidian commented on the strong tone of the cartoons the last week of the 2001 Australian election campaign and added, quote, "Other forms of political analysis might wish to insist on a more nuanced summary of the issues, but the cartoonists went for force rather than subtlety just about every time. They tried to tell the public that the darker angels of our nature were being played on by cynical, poll-driven politicians." And I do notice, you know, in the 20 years that I've been affiliated with Australia, that you picked up all this poll-driven mania. A poll usually is 1,000 people. In a country with almost 20 million people, that's a small slice. It's an even smaller slice in our country with 330 million people. The Australians tried to recognize the morally decent view on asylum seekers and to think that jingoistically about the war on terrorism. "We did not listen," said the two writers. But throughout his life, Pryor was somebody who did listen. He listened to the wide gamut of influences, and he looked at, questioned, and wondered why things were the way they were. From childhood on, he had lots of curiosity and lots of chutzpah. Chutzpah to the point where he had no qualms about signing his own absence notes every time he missed class. And I could see this wicked little boy penning this note. Born in Canberra in 1944, his father was a surveyor, engineer, draftsman, and the city's superintendent of parks and gardens. He was also a science researcher and an adept watercolorist. His mother was the first woman to start and finish a university degree here in Canberra. He described his mother as a great reader and a frustrated writer. She worked for a South Australian parliamentarian. Both his parents were good draftsmen, and his grandfather was a freelance cartoonist who often listened to political debates on the radio. So he kid sometimes prior that this was a genetic adaptation on his part. From his earliest days, Pryor said he was drawing. Quote, "I was a diligent doodler on just about anything that had white space." He won his first prize at the age of 6 or 7 in a competition held by the Farmers Department Store in Sydney. Said Pryor, "I even drew on the desktop at school and got into all sorts of trouble." But it was years before he began cartooning as a serious pursuit, and he has never had any formal study of art. He went to the Australian National University to study law. His parents didn't see much future in anybody for art, let alone for their son. But he did do caricatures of the faculty and staff and got commissions from the economics and law faculties. But he dropped out of school in 1965 and held a series of unusual jobs. He worked as a laborer. He weighed sugar in the grocery store. He drove a taxi. And he worked as a gopher for the public service and did photo retouching and press art for the Canberra Times. He saved his money so he could go overseas. He took a ship to Panama, then flew to Miami. He visited his brother in Indiana in the United States and then headed for Toronto, Canada in 1969. Said Pryor, "It was easy to find work. I had no language difficulties, and it was good at launching pad for traveling further afield." He got a job with the Canadian Broadcasting Company, the CBC, and first worked in accounting and then moved into production and then eventually to videotaping. He was also studying television production and eventually found a job at a studio, but it only lasted for 2 days. During that stage, said Pryor, "I kept up with drawing and did caricatures and drawings of people, sometimes on commissions, including the CBC newsletter, which was distributed throughout Canada." He also visited many Canadian art museums, and in 1974, he went off with a friend to visit the Mediterranean and the Middle East, including Spain, North Africa, Sicily, Italy, Greece, and Turkey. For him, it was literally on the road to Damascus that he decided it was time to get serious about the direction of his life instead of his vagabond existence and to pick up some formal training. When the money ran out, Pryor headed for London and got a job at Asbury's, the Regal Jewelers on Bond Street, in the packing room, wrapping up consignments on crystal and jewelry for distant destinations. He was still working on his drawings and visiting contacts on Fleet Street. On the job as a packer, he was still also working on his wicked sense of humor. Pryor popped in a note on a package he was writing for the Sultan of Oman that said, "Help! Support the Israeli war effort." He didn't last too long at that job either. He moved back to Canada, getting a job as a rust proofer for cars while looking for cartooning jobs. But he also kept an eye on the Canberra Times, which was among the Australian publications on display at the Australian Trade Commission. One day he noticed the resident cartoonist Larry Pickering had left the paper to go to the Australian, so he decided he would go back to Canberra and become the cartoonist for the Canberra Times. 1975 was a turning point for Pryor. With the death of his mother, he came back to Canberra, where he re-enrolled in ANU in the arts program. This time he dove in, and in studying things like international relations, Marxism, African history, the world's revolts and insurgencies. Pryor was also fascinated by courses in comparative religions. Having traveled through Muslim countries and encountering Islam, Pryor said he was curious to know, quote, how they ticked, how they existed in societies, how much of a role religion played, and what it meant to them. Outside the classroom, he again began to freelance for the Canberra Times. In 1978, he had another sea change. At the age of 34, he got married, he acquired a wife and a son, he bought a house, and he officially joined the staff of the Canberra Times, where he remained until his retirement in 2008. Pryor never looked back. As to his evolutionary process of being a cartoonist, he adds, quote, "I can't remember when. I couldn't put my finger on the terms of the time when I decided that I wasn't going to be anybody else, that I was going to be me, and that I would draw cartoons in a way that suited me to get the idea across. And then, over time, I began to develop a sense of political knowledge, political history, and my grasp of the issues became much surer. I became much more competent about which issue was worth a cartoon comment and which wasn't." He is quick to echo the comments of a British cartoonist who influenced him greatly. This man emphasized that, quote, "Humor is serious business. It's not something that you fall about in a state of permanent laughter." And I think sometimes people don't realize that political cartooning is very, very different than sort of a Punch and Judy kind of thing. It can also be a daily straitjacket. Try and imagine 30 years of having to meet a daily deadline. It also provides, however, a worldwide vehicle. Oral history interviewer Ann Turner of the National Library of Australia remarked to Pryor during an interview, quote, "You're drawing for the Canberra audience, but you seldom choose local themes. Is that deliberate?" Pryor responded with a resounding yes. Quote, You have to cast the net as wide as reasonably possible because we are in this business for survival, if nothing else. We have to keep on going from day to day. You've got to be able to deepen and broaden your bag of reference material. Using local references would be self-defeating because I think the readership of Canberra is, by and large, highly educated. They're not parochial. They're cosmopolitan. You can often refer to foreign parts as sources of metaphors and assume the readers know what you're talking about. You can refer to historical incidents and you can assume they know what you're talking about. Before I turn to some specific examples of Pryor's work, I'd like to say a few words about political cartooning in the United States and show a few examples so we have a way of contrast on the styles, techniques, and topics. Probably the most well-known would be Herblock, which he uses as a signature of one word. His career began in 1921 with drawing about President Herbert Hoover and ended in 2001 with President George W. Bush. He spent 55 years at the Washington Post and won three of the top awards, the Pulitzer Prize. This year, the U.S. Library of Congress honored him with an extensive exhibit of work selected from the more than 14,000 pieces they have on file. The things he focused on decades ago are still timely issues in the United States. And these are a couple examples. This one is on unemployment that says, "Don't look now, but he's still standing here." I find this almost chilling that this was done almost 75 years ago. You may know our unemployment rate is now at 9.5%. There are 16.5 million people who are currently unemployed. That does not include the numbers of people who have given up. In terms of political cartooning, President Obama had to submit to the Senate and the House six times a vote to extend unemployment benefits, which normally run out after 6 months. The next one is on racism, 1968. This is interesting, and I probably am naive, but I did not think with the election of our first black president there would be the ugly backlash that continues, with drawings of the president as a black Hitler, the Joker on playing cards. These are widely distributed on alternative media as well as mainstream media. The next one is on energy and climate change, which is a problem in the United States. It's a problem in Australia. It's a problem all over the world. This was a cartoon on the failure to create realistic energy policies coupled with the Iranian hostage crisis, which wound up in the end of President Jimmy Carter's presidency. And the last one is, this is certainly a very contemporary topic about overpaid executives. As you may know, we had massive bailouts for people at the top of our banks. We don't fire from the top, we fire from the bottom. And I thought this, if I'd had time, I would have looked up what the average compensation is. The average compensation for a CEO at one of the top banks is 600% more than the average worker. And this one says, our CEO is a genius. He laid off 1,000 $10,000 a year employees and increased his salary another $10 million. This was done 10 years ago, and it's still right on target. That's a mark of a good cartoonist, that you have a timeless quality. Regardless of country of origin for the cartoon, Herblock seemed to set out the criteria that most of his top-notch fellow cartoonists follow. Quote, a cartoon does not tell everything about its subject. It's not supposed to. No written piece tells everything either. As far as words are concerned, there is no safety in numbers. The test of a written or drawn commentary is where it gets to an essential truth. The next one is the successor to Herblock was a man named Tom Tolles, and he came to the Washington Post in 2002. He tends to focus much more on U.S. issues than international ones, but in a country with 330 million people, you're never short on topics. The first one of his, let's see, is George Bush exiting the White House in the midst of the financial crisis in January 2009. When I flew here in September 2008, it's a 14-hour flight from L.A. to Sydney. In the 14 hours I was in the air, the stock market fell 800 points. And as we were getting off the plane, the pilot said, you might want to pick up a paper that the earth moved while we were flying. And also, Lehman Bank had failed. And I thought what was interesting is it didn't appear to me this would have a profound impact on Australia. But I went on to Gosford, a small town with a major railroad interchange. They had lost $29 million with money they had invested into Lehman. So this ripple effect is something that really takes root. The next one is the day after the November of 2008 election with a vote for the first black president. The quote is from the Declaration of Independence written by Thomas Jefferson. And it says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." Toll likes to focus on people's ears. And so Bush had funny ears. Obama has funny ears. He would probably draw poor Abbott with funny ears, too. The next one, this is also a big controversial topic in Australia and the United States, and this is the gay marriage wedding cake. And you have the Statue of Liberty on one side and the Statue of Justice on the other. You may be aware there was a monumental court decision in California last week. California had had a referendum to outlaw gay marriage, and there was a judge that overturned this referendum. And people were saying, well, this was partisan. This judge had been a Republican for 40 years. He was appointed by Ronald Reagan. The two lawyers that were overturning this ban had both been involved on different sides, Republican and Democrat, in the battle in Bush versus Gore in 2000. This will probably eventually go to the Supreme Court. It's an issue that sorry we don't see more political discussion. It's become a very, very ugly debate. And the last one ran just before I left, and to me, this is where the United States gets the most close for instant impact with Jeff Pryor. This is a snake called gotcha. And it's about U.S. gotcha politics. This was an amazingly ugly event. There was a woman who had worked for the United States Department of Agriculture for many years, a black lady, who was speaking to the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. In her remarks, she had mentioned that when she was younger, she was very upset by the disconnect between black and white people. Her father had been murdered. They found a suspect. It was a white suspect. The case never went to trial. Her husband is a minister and had been involved in civil rights issues for 40 years. A blogger named Andrew Breitbader picked up about 4 minutes out of a 40-minute tape and gave it to Fox. Fox ran with it. CNN ran with it. All of the major media outlets ran with this without ever checking the speech. In the totality of her speech, she had said as she got older and worked that she realized it wasn't race, it was economics, and that poverty affects us all. And this woman had tried to call the Washington office of USDA saying, this is what's happening. After this all blew up, they found out that this call-in line, nobody had answered the phone calls for 4 years. The U.S. Department of Agriculture immediately turned on her and demanded her resignation. The NAACP, who had the full tape, demanded her resignation. And the White House eventually got involved. Nobody has been publicly identified for this, but it's very troubling with the first black president. And this woman is an amazing woman with presence of mind. She called up CNN and said, I would like equal time to tell my story. A very courageous woman. The USDA eventually called and asked her to take the job back, and she said, you know, I really don't know if I want to work there anymore. She should probably have a talk show of her own. We'll go on to the next one. Domestic disputes are a primary target for U.S. cartoons, unlike prior, and I have a few examples here. This one is by Walter Handelsman, who won a Pulitzer Prize for this particular cartoon, and it's called Pirates of the Constitution and features George Bush. There have been many debates because of 9/11 that we had to suspend certain rights because we were at war. That has become a very controversial stand. This man also does digital cartoons, and I don't know what the state of that is in Australia. The next one is from Mike Peters with the Dayton, Ohio News. And what's interesting about this, in the United States, we very, very seldom kid about any phase of the Middle East. It's a very volatile topic. You can't because of ethnic sensitivities, religious sensitivities, geographic sensitivities, there are very few cartoons. And this one is unusual. It shows Obama boasting, "I got them to the table where the fighting continues." Next one. In the United States, we have seen a severe economic consolidation of media, especially in print. And this has hurt political cartoonists. Randy Barrett, a reporter for the National Journal in the United States, estimates there are only 80 full-time cartoonists now at leading metropolitan dailies in the United States. That's down 20% from 200, excuse me, that's down 200 from 220 years ago. About 85% of these are white males who earn an estimated $50,000 to $75,000 a year. He notes that cartoonist-like reporters guard their autonomy fiercely. While working for the now-defunct Buffalo Courier-Express, Tom Toll won the right to lampoon anybody and everybody, and he insisted on full creative control when he joined the Washington Post in 2002. Once you have editorial freedom, it is so important and intrinsic, it's inconceivable to work without it. However, we need to emphasize that independence does not mean that all cartoons get published for a variety of reasons. Rather than raising the issue of censorship, it'd be a question of taste, sensitivities, raw emotions, or being perceived as too offensive to a segment of the audience. And I have two examples of cartoons that were not published in the United States. The first is by Jeff Danziger, who was with the New York Times Syndicate. In 2004, his editors vetoed this cartoon showing President George Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney paddling an American GI Corps down the river during Iraqi and Afghani wars. And I would probably agree with that judgment, that this is a very powerful cartoon. If your son or daughter had died, you probably wouldn't support this cartoon. The second one is by Bob Rogers, who's president of the American Association of Editorial Cartoonists and a staff cartoonist for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And his cartoon shows the Pope with Osama bin Laden, who is seeking sanctuary in a church. This was also when the wide-ranging scandals were going for pedophilia among priests. And this one, they didn't say it was censorship, but it was good taste. Pryor has also had some drawings pulled, and I don't have pictures of these, but I'm sure you can imagine them. Both had to do with the Clinton impeachment scandal. In 1998. One shows Palestine Liberation Organization leader Yasser Arafat in Washington for Middle East peace talks, kept waiting while Clinton was sidetracked by U.S. reporters wanting to talk about the scandal involving a White House intern. The second drawing probably just burned up on the drawing board. This one was described as not censored for political reasons, but for taste. It showed Clinton in a zoo, and a snake specialist swarmed around him warning, "We've got a trouser snake on the loose." However, I did notice that several of the prior cartoons that did run would not have run in the United States, including a drawing of men's underwear with a padlock on it, and one when he was getting ready to give testimony and steam was coming out of his slacks. I'd now like to show you a few random examples of Pryor's razor-like pen. Okay, the first one, he had no problem with drawing the Pope. This is Pope's message to Americans: give up wealth for the poor, and the setting is in the extensive Vatican arts collection. The next one is on the Vietnamese People's Museum of Imperial Villains. They're taking down one and putting up another. I think also that Australians were able to talk about Vietnam long before we could. You still don't have much of a discussion in history. You realize this was a trade opportunity and you moved on, so we wouldn't be kidding much about Vietnam either. The next one is Uganda's dictator Idi Amin in his underwear. The next one is the Shah of Iran, which was a very upheaval type thing with politics in the United States, and it's still a source of upheaval. The next one is Ayatollah Khomeini. The next one, and this is very strong. I'd be interested to know what the reaction was at the time on Aboriginal politics. And it says, "This is what you get when you play white fella politics. Black fella politics ain't exactly a barrel of laughs either." He does make an interesting point. you probably wouldn't see this in the United States, but that's what the politician is looking for, is instant impact. The next one I thought was very funny. Bob Hawke is Moses. For Pete's sake, give me a sign. It's getting chilly up here. The next one would apply to the United States and Australia. It's diplomats. And in the United States, we kid that diplomatic license plates are licensed to kill. There was a Russian who killed two people standing on the sidewalk, and they just sent him home. And this one says, next one is Clinton's trip to the Australia, U.S. employees upstaging John Howard in Parliament House. It says, all this stuff's got to move. This is where we want the president's autocue so he could read it. And drawing of Howard looking not too happy. The next one is Clinton's trip with the Secret Service. And it says, I don't like it. It's all too goddamn peaceful. One Secret Service agent to another in the event of President Clinton's visit in 1996. This wouldn't run in the United States either. Next one is President George Herbert Walker Bush handing over the nuclear broom to his successor, Bill Clinton. And it says, and you might as well have this too. As far as I know, it's never been used. Thank goodness. The next one is what I mentioned earlier, the Fair Trade Bible. Jeff Pryor gave me a copy of this one. This one is very strong. I think, you know, that we should be able to discuss guns in a nonpartisan public safety way, but we haven't quite reached that plateau. The next one is, why is this man smiling? And it's one half is Bill Clinton and the other is Jimmy Carter. And it was the idea that this was a sort of a split personality trying to follow all different sets of policies. The next one is one of the few I think didn't work. It's Colin Powell with the idea of George Bush as a new president with sort of training wheels. And I think it's because Colin Powell is not instantly recognized. Colin Powell has a much thinner face. But it's something when you're talking about instant impact. Just for a show of hands, how many people would know that was Colin Powell? Okay, yeah. The next one is back to the trade wars. It says, you boys are early tonight with bombings on the wheat deal. And the final word is not from Jeff Pryor, but from his colleague on the ever-popular theme of U.S. agricultural trade wars against Australia. And this one is by Maury. And it says, meanwhile, U.S. airstrikes seem imminent. And what makes these things funny is, has anything changed? Thank you very much. I'm happy to take any questions.
You do have a question. Would you please come to the microphone? There are microphones in the gallery as well as down here. Yes. That one.
I'm going to bask in Jeff Pryor's fame because I appointed him.
Terrific.
But the question I've got is that, and you mentioned about some cartoons not being published in the United States because of sensitivities. One of the things that differs in Australia is that our defamation laws are much stricter than yours. And I hid behind Jeff Pryor a lot because you can't call a politician a liar, but you can draw him with a Pinocchio nose. And Jeff Pryor did this very well. So my question really is, in what way do cartoonists defame people?
That would be tough. Well, I know that the Australian press law is different with the case of the Sydney restaurant person that said the food was terrible, and people said, yes, that was true, but the person filing the claim still won. We go back to 1793 with what we would call truth as a defense, the John Peter Zenger defense. And if you can prove something is true, then it's not defamation. I think it's tough to know who's a public and a private person anymore. What is covered by privacy? I'm amazed we can get anybody to run for office in any country anymore because if you had a third cousin that ran off at 12 or anything that you've done, it's open to such public scrutiny. So in terms of defamation, I've seen some things in the papers in the last 2 weeks that I thought were verging on defamation. I think it's interesting, too, with this particular campaign that you would focus on somebody not having children. And I would say, as somebody that has one child, perhaps you're better off than coming back home to mother with three kids saying, well, gee, that was a bad decision. You know, that you're focusing on somebody's underwear, somebody's hair, how well you talk or don't talk. It's character assassination maybe more than defamation because there's so few issues. But I think Jeff Breyer could do a whole lot more than we could have done in the United States. And I think it's with 330 million people, you're bound to offend somebody, even if it's only the person's mother that you're drawing the cartoon about. I'm not a lawyer. And I mean, I worked at the Chicago Tribune and other publications, and everything goes to the lawyers now. What was interesting, Tom Tolles does 4 cartoons a day, and then they circulate it among the editorial staff to see what will go. And I'm thinking, it would be hard enough to do 1 a day, but to circulate 4, and, you know, do we have 8 people and we do the best out of 8? That seems to me somewhat of a compromise, but I think everything in America is so legalistic that everybody says to their kids, major in law, you'll always get a job. Anyone else?
Are there any other questions?
And I understand Jeff Pryor's daughter was coming, and unfortunately, I don't know who you are, but if you're here, maybe you'd identify yourself. No. She also was on Deadline.
Hello.
Thank you very much. We love your dad. We don't always agree, but we still like
him. We certainly do. And Kathleen, I think your talk today has been fascinating, showing us the distinctions between works of cartoonists here and in America. And for that, we all thank you very much for making the time available and for visiting us again. And we hope you'll be back.
I do.
Please join me in
taking
questions. And we'll see you all again next time. Thank you.